A peace proposal by Egypt for Gaza gets pushback from both sides as fighting in the Strip continues and the families of hostages demand action.
We expect them to do anything they can to bring back the hostages.
The United Nations has been strained to the limit by global conflicts.
The kinds of conflicts the UN has been facing over the last year have been exactly the kinds of conflicts that the UN is least well equipped to manage.
And as the world reels from climate change, with water drying up and crop yields declining, using science to do more with less.
We are providing less water to more people today than we did two decades ago, and that's because of water conservation.
Today is Tuesday, December 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to keep up the fight against Hamas militants. Palestinians are mourning more than 100 people who Gaza health officials say were killed overnight in Israeli airstrikes. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman examines these developments as a new peace proposal is put forward by Egypt.
The Israeli government on Monday released footage of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, clad in a helmet and Kevlar vest, arriving by tank to greet soldiers inside the Gaza Strip. He tells them the war is not over. It will end in total victory, no less than that. His remarks come after reports that the leaders of Hamas, the Palestinian Islamist group that governed Gaza, rejected an Egyptian proposal that they relinquish power in the enclave in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. That's according to two Egyptian security sources who spoke to Reuters on Monday. An official from Hamas later denied what the sources said about the talks. Fighting in Gaza erupted after Palestinian fighters rampaged through Israeli communities on October 7th, killing 1,200 and taking hundreds of captives. Israel retaliated with a full-blown invasion aimed at eradicating Hamas and bringing the captives home. Punishing airstrikes and ground maneuvers have transformed cities into wastelands, and Gaza's health ministry said last week the death toll had topped 20,000. Thousands more are believed buried beneath the rubble. The last 48 hours have been particularly deadly. At least 70 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Mughazi refugee camp in the middle of the Gaza Strip. A warning to viewers, this video includes graphic images of death and destruction. Ibrahim Muhammad Al-Haj Yusuf lost his wife and four children in the attack. He told Reuters, quote, "My wife and children are still trapped inside. I only managed to uncover my eldest son, Muhammad. What fault did they have? Why did this happen to them? It's not their fault. The world watches us die and being slaughtered. Are these the resistance? They are innocent children." The Israeli army said it was reviewing the report of the Mughazi strike and was committed to minimizing harm to civilians. Israel says Hamas operates in densely populated areas and uses civilians as human shields, which Hamas denies. Egypt and Qatar have shuttled between Hamas and Israel in an effort to reach some kind of a ceasefire that might provide for the return of hostages and the delivery of humanitarian aid. The Egyptian sources said that Hamas had rejected offering any concessions beyond the possible release of more hostages in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. Israel says it would consider a temporary pause in fighting in exchange for prisoners, but it would not consider a permanent ceasefire that leaves Hamas in control of Gaza. The footage released by Israel showed Netanyahu glad-handing with combat soldiers who pledge until the end. But back in parliament that day, he faced heckling from some hostages' families. They chanted, "Now, now, now," and demanding that he pursue the release of captives at all costs. Netanyahu responded that an earlier ceasefire, which resulted in the release of some 100 captives, would not have happened without military pressure on Hamas. More than 100 Israelis are believed still held hostage in Gaza.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. Hamas is designated a terrorist group by the U.S. and others. Even though Hamas has rejected specific points in the Egyptian peace proposal, and it runs contrary, the proposal runs contrary to Israel's stated objectives, it could be a starting point to move forward. I spoke to VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the plan and that possibility.
It's a three-stage deal, and that the Egyptians are proposing. In the first stage, it would be similar to the ceasefire or the temporary ceasefire and the hostage exchange that we saw in November, in which Hamas would release 40 of the hostages, and Israel would cease its fire and allow much more humanitarian aid in, and there would be a release of Palestinian prisoners. The second stage would be Hamas and the Palestinian Authority would cooperate to form a technocratic government that could deal with immediate issues in Gaza. And the third stage would be a long-term ceasefire, the release of all thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, and the freedom for the rest of the hostages.
I saw that Prime Minister Netanyahu has vowed to keep up the fight and until Hamas is gone. He just said it again.
Yes, he keeps saying it again. You know, he also, the fact that he keeps saying it doesn't mean that that's what's going to happen. But Israel has said all along that it has two goals in this operation. One is to get rid of Hamas's military power, and the second is to get the freedom for all of the hostages. Now, there were, before the war started, there were an estimated 25,000 Hamas fighters. Israel said this week that it had killed 8,000 of them since the war began. But that means that there's still quite a lot of Hamas fighters believed to be hiding in tunnels underneath Gaza. And while Israel has come pretty close to completing what it says are its operations in the north of Gaza, and most of the population has moved south, there are still large areas in southern Gaza that Israel has not yet taken control of, specifically Khan Yunis, which is where it believed that many of the Hamas leadership at least was hiding, and Rafah, which is the city on the border between Gaza and Egypt. Israel says that in order to achieve its goals, it's going to take a long time and many more months of fighting.
You know, I saw earlier in the week the movie Golda about Golda Meir and the 73 war. And I couldn't help, as I watched it, think how much of a parallel there was between then and now, particularly in terms of Israel not standing alone so much, but the rest of the world saying, you have to do this and you have to do that. And like Netanyahu, you know, Golda Meir said, they have to believe that this is what I want to do, or we're not going to get what we want or what we need to survive. Is the movie resonating at all in Israel? I mean, are people watching it, talking about it?
So the movie, actually, I saw it at the premiere in Israel, which was at the first night of the big, there's always a big Jerusalem Film Festival every year, and they show it on an outdoor screen with the walls of Jerusalem's old city in the background, and that was in the summer. And then it was sort of just a movie. And since October 7th, it's pretty amazing, you know, also the fact of how much of a surprise the attack was, and how the Israeli intelligence community was caught unawares. That said, it doesn't seem to be making such a strong wave here as you would think. I think a lot of Israelis kind of see Golda Meir as ancient history. You know, there's been so much focused on the war. Today is 80 days since the war started. And of course, the rate of Israeli soldiers being killed is also increasing. Israel drafted 350,000 reserve soldiers, which Israel's a country of 9 million people. So that's a huge amount. And it's really causing a huge burden on the economy, on their families, on all kinds of things. So I think people see this war in Gaza really as an existential war for Israel's future. And they're not really thinking about Golda Meir right now.
I guess it's something only afforded the luxury if you're not there.
Right, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you, Scott.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. The war between Israel and Hamas is not the only new war to break out in 2023. Coupled with growing hunger worldwide, the increased poverty on a warming planet, we often look to the United Nations to fix it. But as we hear now from VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir, there is little they can do. And as we look to the UN's future, it looks like a world where its impact is shrinking.
In 2023, the war in Ukraine entered its second year, with no peace on the horizon. Military coups destabilized parts of Africa, and new and deadly wars arose in Sudan and the Middle East. The United Nations has had little success in stopping the bloodshed. Anjali Dayal teaches international relations at New York's Fordham University.
It's particularly been challenging because the kinds of conflicts the UN has been facing over the last year have been exactly the kinds of conflicts that the UN is least well-equipped to manage. They're conflicts between the big permanent members of the Security Council. And when those countries are involved, the UN has the least scope for action.
That's because Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States can use their vetoes to block sanctions and other tools the Council can use to maintain peace and security. This past year, geopolitical divisions intensified over Russia's war in Ukraine, and since October, Washington's support for Israel's war against Hamas. Richard Gowan is UN Director for the International Crisis Group.
And the mood in the Security Council now is poisonous.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres was unable to unblock the paralysis by invoking in December the rarely used Article 99 of the UN Charter to press the Council for a humanitarian ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. The United States vetoed his appeal, and Israel called for his resignation. The news wasn't much better for the UN's peacekeeping efforts in the field. The organization's blue helmets mark 75 years of peace operations this year. But the anniversary comes as Mali and the Democratic Republic of Congo demand that UN forces leave their territory, and as Haiti appeals for an international force to help stabilize the country, just not a UN one. In Africa, leaders are turning more to forces drawn from regional blocs to deal with sub-Saharan crises. This, along with peacekeeping's hefty annual budget of more than $6 billion, has prompted questions about the efficiency, value, and need for present and future missions. Head of UN Peace Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix.
Moving forward, what we think we should work together with the member states on is to make sure that UN peacekeeping operation, when they are warranted, will be fit for purpose. And when it's about enforcement, not peacekeeping, then it's not for UN peacekeeping to do enforcement, it's for other form of operation.
One hopeful moment came at the COP28 climate conference in Dubai. Delegates agreed for the first time on the need to move away from fossil fuels, a major driver of global warming. With climate change intensifying natural disasters, conflicts, and other global shocks, the UN has been called upon more to mobilize delivery of humanitarian assistance. Again, Fordham University professor Anjali Dayal.
We see both things, right? We see that even when there's diminished political space to broker political solutions to conflicts or to human crises, there's still the real potential to do important, significant work on the humanitarian scale, but it has to be funded, it has to be supported in order to get the sort of greatest impact.
Over decades, many have called for reforms to the UN, including expanding Security Council representation to reflect current realities. Again, Crisis Group analyst Richard Gowan.
The UN was paralyzed for long periods of the Cold War. So the fact that it is once again going through a period of crisis doesn't mean that it's dead. I think there is a real need to think about the structures of the UN and how they could be changed.
The problem, the analysts say, is there is little consensus on how to change the organization for the better. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
We're following these other stories from around the world. A plane carrying 276 Indian passengers has landed in Mumbai after it was grounded for 4 days in France, pending an investigation into possible human trafficking. Two people investigated for human trafficking have been placed under assisted witness status while the investigation continues. Police say another 25 people, including 5 minors, have stayed in France where they say they want to seek asylum. The death toll in the weekend attacks in the central Nigerian state of Plateau has risen to 160, according to a local official. It's a region where clashes between herders and farmers over natural resources are common, intensified by rapid population growth and climate pressures. Military gangs called bandits are believed to be behind the coordinated attacks. People are fleeing their homes to escape the violence. Beijing has broken its cold record for hours of sub-zero temperatures in December. The record dates back to 1951. A cold wave swept the country, sending temperatures towards historic lows in some areas in the Northeast, hitting minus 40 degrees Celsius. Jailed Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny fell off the radar, but now has been tracked down. His spokesperson says he's in a penal colony north of the Arctic Circle. It's a notorious facility that Reuters correspondent Emma Jalee says is nicknamed the Polar Wolf.
Spokesperson Kira Yarmish told Reuters that Navalny's lawyer managed to see him on Monday, the first time since supporters raised the alarm about his fate on December 6th.
Him today, so he is well. Especially given the fact that he was transferred for 3 weeks to this place.
Navalny is among the highest profile political figures opposing Russian President Vladimir Putin. He has endured exile, assassination attempts, and now prison. Navalny earned admiration when he voluntarily returned to Russia in 2021 from Germany, where he had been treated for what Western laboratory tests showed was an attempt to poison him with a nerve agent. The Kremlin denied trying to kill him and said there was no evidence he was poisoned. His supporters cast him as a future leader of Russia, who will one day walk free from jail to lead his country. For now, he is held in what is considered to be one of the toughest prisons in Russia. The Polar Wolf was founded in the 1960s as part of what was once the Gulag system of forced Soviet labor camps. Temperatures are expected to drop to negative 18 degrees Fahrenheit over the next week.
We know for sure that in this new colony, his conditions would be even worse than they were before. But the thing is that this colony is very distant. It is very difficult to access it. And for lawyers, it will be very, very difficult to go there and to see Alexei.
Navalny's lawyer suggested that Russian authorities wanted to isolate him ahead of the March presidential election.
Reuters correspondent Emma Jalee, who says Navalny denies all charges he's been convicted of, and casts Russia's judicial system as deeply corrupt. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Climate change and population surge have put an incredible strain on global resources. Even if we mitigate global warming, we still have to learn to live with the effects that will be with us for decades. Here's an example. The Colorado River in the United States is the water source for most of the Southwest U.S. About 40 million people get their water from the river. But population growth, farming expansion, climate change, a drought for the past 24 years, has collapsed the river's water flow. But there is hope in the form of innovation. In part two of his series, River at Risk, VOA's Matt Dibble takes us to one of the river's cities where they are doing more with the less they get from the river.
The sprawling city of Las Vegas is in one of the most arid regions of the United States. This dazzling oasis with a reputation for excess would seem to be an unlikely model for water conservation. But the city is a water success story.
Our community's consumption of Colorado River water has declined by approximately 30%, while our community's population has also increased by more than 750,000 people during that same time. We are providing less water to more people today than we did two decades ago, and that's because of water conservation.
The biggest savings come from recycling wastewater and sending it back into nearby Lake Mead to be used again.
We have the Colorado River system. We take water out of the Boulder Basin of the Lake Mead, We bring it into the Las Vegas Valley as our drinking water source. When the water goes back in the sanitary sewer system, we bring that to a treatment plant that's close to the Las Vegas Wash. We treat the water to very, very high standards. The water goes back into the Las Vegas Wash and goes back into Lake Mead, and then we reuse it again.
Which means that some of the wastewater being treated here could end up flowing from a tap on the Las Vegas Strip again in just a few days.
And the only way that can happen is if we treat this water very, very effectively.
This state-of-the-art facility lets microorganisms do most of the work.
We have to treat to a level that's above 98% of the other treatment plants around the country. So after this water leaves here, it's going to travel to Las Vegas Wash, which is just to our east. Then it goes down to the Las Vegas Bay of Lake Mead, and at that point it's re-entered the Colorado River system.
For every liter of water returned to the system, Las Vegas can remove a liter without counting against its overall allocation. For the 60% of water that never becomes wastewater, the city has taken other steps, like limiting swimming pool size and evaporative cooling systems. Grass lawns, which are notorious water consumers, are banned in new housing developments. And the city pays homeowners to replace existing grass with desert landscaping. And to make sure the rules are enforced, there is a team of water cops.
Runoff due to misaligned sprinklers along the sidewalk. Water is running down into the gutter.
Johnny Cerrone is one of 14 wastewater investigators who patrol the city looking for infractions, like watering on the wrong day or faulty sprinklers.
We are actually out here to, most of everything is to educate people. Most of the people, they are grateful when we let them know that something is wrong, and they're like, oh, that's why my water bill is so high.
As successful as these efforts have been, the region will still need to conserve more. To meet new requirements, Nevada has agreed to cut around one quarter of its current yearly allocation for the next 3 years. And the population continues to grow. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Las Vegas, Nevada.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest terms North Korea's recent intercontinental ballistic missile and short-range ballistic missile launches, said Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations. For the fifth time this year, North Korea has launched an intercontinental ballistic missile in direct violation of multiple Security Council resolutions. This is in addition to the 26 other ballistic missiles the DPRK launched this year alone, noted Ambassador Wood.
We have used every word to describe the DPRK's continued threats to international peace and security. Flagrant, unacceptable, reckless, egregious. Let me be extremely clear. The United States and our allies are working to protect ourselves from the very nuclear weapons delivery systems the DPRK is testing and has repeatedly stated are made for attacking us.
We are grateful that most of the Security Council has condemned North Korea's mounting threat to international peace and security. Most of this council is committed to upholding the resolutions we adopted, said Ambassador Wood.
Now it is on Russia and China to join us, to act as if their credibility as a responsible permanent members depends on it. Not only would we be sending a message to the DPRK and any proliferator, but we have seen firsthand the benefits of coming together to hold the DPRK accountable.
It has become clear that North Korea remains able to advance its weapons of mass destruction program due to its extensive efforts to evade sanctions. Until North Korea abandons its WMD program and instead engages in meaningful negotiations, we will continue to call out its sanctions violations, affirmed Ambassador Wood.
We are here because the DPRK must understand that the only viable path forward is through diplomacy and our continued commitment to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and it cannot do that while this council stays silent.
It is critical that the international community makes crystal clear that this escalatory behavior has consequences, said Ambassador Wood. We urge all council members to join us in holding North Korea to account once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.